In his memoir, former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin recalled a conversation that he had had with Israel's first leader, David Ben-Gurion, in 1948. Israel was, at the time, carrying out the Nakba, the catastrophe that came along with the official formation of the Israeli state. Rabin writes, "We walked outside, Ben-Gurion accompanying us. Alon, who was an Israeli army officer, repeated his question, 'What is to be done with the Palestinian population?' Ben-Gurion waved his hand in a gesture which said, 'Drive them out.' I agreed. This was essential." In 1948, the Israeli government censored these lines, cautious of revealing the brutality that had been crucial to the formation of their state. But Rabin was honest in his memoir. The formation of Israel was made possible by the expulsion that he and Ben-Gurion had spoken about, by extreme acts of destruction and inhumanity. Between 1947 and 1949, 750,000 Palestinians fled their homes. Entire towns were burnt to the ground, bombed or fired upon. Some 15,000 people were murdered in cold blood. This, the creation of Israel, was the goal that the first Zionists had set themselves, and that the world's imperialist powers had thrown their weight behind. And it was no accident that it came into being this way. But I want to start further back at the beginning. Zionism, the ideology which underpins the state of Israel, goes back much further than 1948. In fact, it emerged as a political current in the 1800s, and I'll run through some of that history. But to tell the story of Zionism is not enough. Zionism would be nothing more than a set of irrelevant middle-class ideas if it weren't for the backing, not just ideological, but military and economic backing, of major imperialist powers. So this talk is about the origins of Israel, from the earliest serious colonization efforts in the 1910s to the catastrophe of 1948, which established the modern-day state. It's a history which has, at every moment, been about strengthening the power of major capitalist nations at the expense of millions of Palestinians. It started, really, with the birth of capitalism and the carving up of the world into colonies for the major powers to exploit and oppress. Capitalist nations fought each other bitterly for territory and the resources, markets, labor power, and advantage over their competitors, which each new colony brought them. The Middle East was important right from these early days. It was home to crucial trade routes and valuable commodities, and the powers of Western Europe had their eyes on the region. That is what created the useful crossover of interest between the Zionist movement and the imperialist powers, and in these early stages, mostly Britain. So Zionism. Zionism first emerged in the late 1800s as a political demand of a section of the Jewish middle class for a Jewish state. It wasn't a great time to be Jewish in Europe. Waves of anti-Semitic pogroms were sweeping across Eastern Europe, whipped up particularly by the Tsarist Russian regime. But at this point, far from the claims of Zionism today to represent all Jewish people, this was a tiny minority current in the late 1800s. Largely taken up by better-off Jewish people who were frustrated by the barriers that anti-Semitism presented to their social ascent. Ordinary Jewish workers were far, far more likely to be members of organizations like the Bund, a left-wing group which saw the fight against oppression as inherently tied up in the battle against exploitation. Right from this beginning, in the late 1800s, the small numbers who made up the Zionist movement saw that they would have to ally themselves with an imperialist power. Because anywhere they might like to set themselves up, they would require a project of military aggression and colonization. So they spent years petitioning different ruling classes to support their endeavors. The attitude of Zionists to anti-Semitism was a defeatist one right from the start. So the left-wing Jews I was talking about before in the Bund saw their oppression as something to fight against where they were, and they were made a point of it. Zionists, on the other hand, proclaimed that anti-Semitism was totally unavoidable when Jews lived alongside non-Jews. The unfortunate Jews, Theodor Herzl, the theoretical founder of Zionism, wrote, are now carrying the seeds of anti-Semitism into England. They have already introduced it into America. Those seeds of anti-Semitism he's talking about is the mere presence of Jewish people in those nations. And so then, for the Zionists, there could be no hope of changing things or finding solidarity with others. Instead, Zionism said the only hope was escape. And even worse, It said that the key thing Jewish people should do was take up the methods of the oppressors. They should work alongside the leaders of racist states to help form their own. So, back to Herzl. The anti-Semites will become our most dependable friends. The anti-Semitic countries are allies. In Zionism's early days, there were bitter debates about where this proposed Jewish state was going to be. They debated Cyprus and Egypt. They sent a team to East Africa, the Zionist Congress did, in the early 1900s to investigate whether a so-called Uganda proposal was viable. But Palestine had crucial advantages. There was a simpler religious justification, and crucially, it was located right at the centre of a region the British wanted to control. So, in 1916, anticipating the fall of the Ottoman Empire in the First World War, Britain and France signed what was known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement. It was a secret treaty which assigned France colonial rule over parts of the areas now known as Syria and Lebanon up here in the north. The British, for their part, took southern and central Iraq and Palestine. In itself, Palestine at this point was not of major economic interest, but it was key in the defence of British positions in Egypt. There was a problem, though. Without a loyal population in the region, it was very difficult to keep a lid on local revolts and rebellions. The plans of the Zionists were increasingly aligning with the interests of British imperialism. So this was why, in 1917, British Foreign Secretary Lord Balfour issued the Balfour Declaration, a promise to support the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. Balfour himself knew that, dependent on the British state for backup, the Jewish population would be helpful and loyal allies in the region. And then there was the added benefit in his eyes of preventing the so-called problem of Jewish migration to Western Europe by transferring them elsewhere. Balfour was a well-known Protestant anti-Semite who sponsored a bill in 1905 to prevent Eastern European Jews fleeing pogroms from immigrating to England. Herzl and the Zionists had no real problem with this. In fact, they touted it to the European leaders as a benefit of the Zionist Palestine scheme. So this really was the concerted start or concerted effort to begin colonizing the region. Between 1920 and 1948, Palestine was under British mandate, meaning that Britain ran the administration and stationed their troops in the region. And they facilitated Jewish migration to Palestine throughout this period, also funded by a bunch of Zionist organizations like this one, who advertised to Jews elsewhere to fund their project. But the numbers of Jewish immigrants were limited. The vast majority of Jewish people all the way from the 1910s through to the post-World War II period preferred to migrate to the US or the UK. This was a big problem for the Zionist leaders. Zionism had claimed that it was establishing a land without a people for a people without a land. But there were, in fact, people in Palestine, and Palestinians put up resistance to having their land and livelihoods stolen from them. Between 1936 and 1937 in particular, an enormous rebellion took place. The discovery of British shipments of weapons for Zionist terrorist organisations in 1935, the murder by British forces of popular Palestinian leaders, and the inspiration of enormous strikes in Syria which had broken out against French rule led to tensions which soon erupted into open revolt. Enormous strikes of Palestinian workers shut down the economy, and Palestinian resistance groups in the countryside organised attacks on institutions of British and Zionist power. In response, the British and Zionist military forces subjected Palestinians to vicious beatings, house raids, torture, and deportation. Zionist paramilitaries, like the Haganah, which would later go on to help form the IDF, played a major role in repressing the uprising. They put down the revolt, but they could not stop the emergence of Palestinian resistance to colonial rules in the years between the world wars. All of that was a major problem for the Zionists, who wanted total control over what they saw as their emerging nation. They spoke openly of wanting a Jewish majority state, which required two things. Firstly, the dispossession, economic exclusion, and expulsion of Palestinians, which they referred to euphemistically as transfer. And secondly, the creation of a larger Jewish population. The first of these aims, expelling Palestinians, had been spoken of since the early days of settlement. All the way back in 1895, Theodore Herzl commented that if Israel were to be established, it ought to discreetly and circumspectly transfer the Arabs out of Palestine. As it would play out, the oppression and expulsion of Palestinians was anything but discreet. The early Zionists painted an idyllic picture of a land of freedom and liberation, but it was clear that this was to be at the expense of the Palestinians. So this took place in a few different ways. Palestinians were excluded from the workforce. Throughout the 1920s and 30s, the Histadrut, the Jewish labor organization, organized pickets and physical violence to enforce a strict Jewish-only labor policy at Jewish-owned workplaces. And you can see here an advertisement calling on people not to buy Palestinian-grown watermelons. This was pretty common. Palestinians were pushed off their land physically to make way for Zionist settlements. And the Zionists bought up land from rich Palestinian landlords who put their own interests before those of the broader population. Zionist terrorist militias grew in order to steal land by force. And despite early promises that they would not dispossess the Palestinian population, British forces enacted vicious retribution on Palestinians who dared to fight back against this project. Demands to more rapidly force Palestinians off their land grew in the aftermath of the 1930s Palestinian Revolt, and attacks on Palestinians by Zionist militias escalated. In an October 1937 letter, Ben-Gurion wrote, "We must expel Arabs and take their place." Gone was Herzl's talk of discretion. The second aim of the Zionists in the interwar years, increasing the Jewish population in Palestine, was a challenge. Zionists in Europe came up with new ways to try to do this, attempting to appeal to left-wing workers through labor Zionism. They took on the language of the labor movement and of socialism even to claim that their new homeland was going to be one of total equality and social harmony. The kibbutzim, collective farms which became the basic units of Zionist settlement, were advertised as beautiful expressions of socialism. In reality, the land bought up at low prices from Arab landlords, or simply stolen, was not exactly what the Jewish population, largely Eastern European, was used to. Many left because of the sheer difficulty of cultivating it. And then, of course, there was no equality between Jews and the local population, and the members of the kibbutzim were largely armed in order to enforce the theft of land. The Histadrut, the trade union organization, was hardly creating a socialist world. Instead, its project was laying the foundations for apartheid, hardly a normal trade union activity. So despite the efforts of the labor Zionists to broaden out the base of support for migration to Palestine, most Jews remained oppositional. Of those who did go to Israel, a huge proportion turned around and left again. The Jewish population until the Second World War remained relatively small. The British, for their part, were trying to deal with competing tensions. They didn't care about Palestine really because of the Zionist population. They cared about it for imperialist reasons. Their imperialist position in the region meant balancing the interests of all sorts of different groups, including Arab leaders who they were relying on for control over their other territories. The crushing of the Palestinian revolt in the 30s had inflamed tensions with people, but also obviously with the Palestinian population. They had been required to mobilise a full third of the British army at the time to put down this revolt. So in 1939, the British published a white paper. This is their statement of policy, an attempt to balance everyone's grievances while maintaining British interests. The paper promised a Jewish home in an independent Palestinian state within 10 years, but it also placed limits on Jewish migration to Palestine and restricted the rights of Zionists to buy up land. This satisfied basically nobody. It was rejected by Palestinians, obviously, but also set off a wave of attacks against the British by Zionist militias who thought that they were being shortchanged. In 1944, they killed the Minister of State, British Minister of State for the Middle East. And then 2 years later, they bombed the King David Hotel, which was the British administrative headquarters. So Britain, at this point, was struggling to play its role as world policemen, and the Zionists were ramping up their terrorisation of Palestinians. All of that, of course, was taking place during the era of the Nazis. And I think this period, more than any other, demonstrates that Zionism has nothing really to do with protecting Jews. The horrific persecution of Jewish people in Europe during the Holocaust caused hundreds of thousands to flee Nazi-controlled regions. During the war, while this was happening, key Zionist leaders actually worked to prevent Jewish migration to places other than Israel. In 1938, just a month after Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass, David Gurion put this plainly. The Nazis in one night had just forced 30,000 Jewish men into concentration camps and destroyed thousands of synagogues, Jewish homes, and Jewish-owned shops. The future Israeli Prime Minister told the Central Committee of his Zionist party, "If I knew that it was possible to save all the children of Germany by transporting them to England, and only half by transporting them to the land of Israel, I would choose the latter." So the Zionists were clear. The state they wanted was more important than the fate of European Jews. World War II also bolstered Zionism as a political current because it crushed those pesky radical ideas like revolutionary socialism, which had a base in the Jewish working class and opposed the settlement of Palestine. And Zionist arguments were able to land easier with Jewish people who were at the time suffering one of the greatest atrocities in human history. In the years following World War II, the great capitalist powers struggled to figure out what to do. Britain was waning, and America was on the rise as the world's key imperialist nation. Britain was increasingly worried about getting bogged down in the region, and Mandate Palestine was becoming increasingly untenable. But they still had an interest in maintaining this Western-backed population in the Middle East, and they saw it useful as a place to relocate Jewish refugees. So much for the idea that the Allies went specifically to fight the Nazis to save Jewish people. During the war, America was literally denying visas to hundreds of thousands of Jews seeking safety and turning refugee boats around. So the Zionist settlement was useful, but a new way of running it was necessary. And so, in 1947, the partition plan was put together. The United Nations General Assembly voted to approve the recommendation that Palestine be partitioned. I think it's useful to know when you look at the uselessness of the UN in preventing the genocide of Gazans, which has taken place over the last couple of years. It actually, the UN, as one of its very first acts, set up the Israeli settler state. The vast majority of Palestinians opposed the partition plan, which gave 55% of land to the Jewish population, who at this point was still only a third of the population. But it didn't matter what Palestinians thought. The weapons and economic funding of the imperialist powers have never been allocated on the basis of popular opinion. In May 1948, Israel declared independence, on a day now marked by Palestinians as the start of the Nakba, or catastrophe. Within minutes, their state was officially recognized by both America and the USSR, who were determined to ensure the carving up of the world in the interests of the victors of the World War. Australia, too, was quick to jump on board. After a moment of uncertainty caused by the fact that the Conservatives, the Liberals, just wanted direct British rule over the Middle East still, Australia ended up playing a very key role in manoeuvring to ensure that the vote for the 1948 partition plan was successful. And the Labour Party were key to this. They were much more adaptable to the changing face of imperialism. They could see the waning of the British Empire, the rise of the US, and the need for an ally in the Middle East. So in December of 1943, the Australian Labour Party's National Conference declared its support for the creation of a Jewish national home in Palestine through immigration and settlement. A key figure of this process was the Labour parliamentarian Doc Evatt, who led support for Israel and saw this as a way to propel Australia into some influence on the global stage. The forces of the Israeli state were in the midst of the most brutal wave of violence in Palestinian history. The Zionist leadership had just formally approved Plan Dalet, which amounted to a blueprint for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. The massacres being carried out were calculated attacks designed to create a Jewish majority state. Zionist gangs had begun to collect information on the names, locations, and residents of Palestinian villages, which they used to carry out a bloody campaign of massacres. They targeted Jerusalem, Haifa, Lida and Ramla, Yaffa, and more. Some 500 towns were depopulated. In one of the most brutal massacres, on April 9th, the Irgun would attack Deir Yassin and kill 254 women and children. This was systematic. The voices of those screaming as they were forced from their homes in death marches or fired upon were recorded and played back by Israeli forces from vans as they drove into new areas to encourage more people to flee. Areas designated as Palestinian territory in the initial partition plan were not off limits. and all of this set in motion mass displacement of Palestinians, some fleeing as far as the east bank of the River Jordan. It's hard to capture the brutality of the Nakba, except that we have seen some of its horror reflected in Gaza over the last 2 years. So this was the foundation of Israel, and I think its history as a state smashes so many of the myths about it. I think the first is that there is some kind of peaceful two-state solution with a neat line drawn between Israeli and Palestinian territory. All the way back in the 1940s, the Nakba made it clear that the so-called two-state solution, which was set up by the UN with its partition plan, could never work. The Israeli state in its formation was based on a mass terror campaign on top of the legitimation of acts of extrajudicial brutality. This is not compatible with accepting the boundaries of a sovereign Palestinian state. It's a recipe for Israel continuing to expand into the land of a people whose existence they frequently deny. It's a recipe for mass bombing campaigns and for a system of supremacy and apartheid. The most hard-right Zionists knew this from the beginning. One of them, Vladimir Jabotinsky, commented in 1923, "We cannot give any compensation for Palestine, neither to the Palestinians nor to other Arabs. Therefore, a voluntary agreement is inconceivable. All colonization, even the most restricted, must continue in defiance of the will of the native population." And that is exactly what has happened. And you can see here the shrinking of Palestinian territory. The second myth is that we can look to institutions like the UN, to international law, to stop Israel's atrocities. International law created and legitimized Israel. Now, when Israel carries out its massacres, the only answer of the UN is a two-state solution, which they lack both the power and the will to enforce. They accept the legitimacy of a Jewish ethnostate. In fact, they set it up. They just want Israel to perhaps stop the endless bombing campaigns, and their answer is to plead with Israel to respect the borders that they drew up. When the institutions do deign to rule against Israel, as they did when they declared Netanyahu a war criminal, Israel just refuses to respect their authority. The great powers declare that they will not carry out the arrest warrant, and they welcome Netanyahu to their stages with open arms and standing ovations. I think the history of Israel has also proved that there was no more left-wing Zionist alternative. Labour or socialist Zionism promised a land of milk and honey, and it was a total illusion. Israel is very obviously not a land of equality, and socialism is never built by going and setting up a new state, especially when the establishment of that state is a colonial expansionist project. The trajectory that Israel has taken is not an accident. So in the 1920s, Jabotinsky, the quote I read before, he was denounced for openly arguing that colonization should proceed regardless of the native population. He said that it should proceed behind an iron wall which the native population cannot breach. At the time, that was unthinkable. People were angry about it. But the walls through the West Bank and encircling Gaza demonstrate that this is no longer an unimaginable overstep for Israel. This is the logic of Zionism. It's the expansion of a colonial apartheid state. So there was no way to reconcile socialism and Zionism in those early days. And actually, you know, nowadays they're finding it hard to even reconcile liberalism with Zionism in Israel. And then I think one of the key myths that's disproven by this early history, that if we could only abolish the Zionist lobby, we could stop the politicians being so beholden to Israel and therefore stop the massive flow of arms and funding which runs from the West to Israel. But this overlooks the whole reason that Israel receives support. So Israel, in the period after World War II, found itself a new ally in the United States as Britain was on the decline. America was in its ascendancy, and it knew, exactly like Britain in its heyday, that an ally in the Middle East would be a crucial part of imperialist control of the world. America was the first country to formally recognize the state of Israel, and since 1948, Israel has become the largest cumulative recipient of American foreign aid. The American ruling class, they know why they're funding Israel. It's not really just about the lobbyist or some set of shared values. It's about a set of imperialist interests. So there are people, disgustingly, who are paid full-time to wander around the halls in Washington and try and convince politicians to go further in their support of Israel, who offer free trips, who write propaganda, and who draw up lists of students on campuses who participated in pro-Palestine activism for deportation by Donald Trump. But these people are not the key reason behind the West's support of Israel. The money of lobbies which advocate for support of Israel is pocket change when compared to the vast interests of capitalism in controlling the Middle East. It's why even if our side had just as much money to splash on lobbying for Palestine, we would not be able to change the tide by promising a bribe to a few politicians. As Biden famously said, support for Israel is the best $3 billion investment America makes. And actually, you know, it's risen to a lot more than $3 billion nowadays. Well, they're not on Israel, he says. The United States of America would have to invent one to protect her interests in the region. For the politicians in the West, control of the wealth that flows through the Middle East justifies the crimes of the Israeli state. So, Zionism, with its brutal history, has always been a capitalist project, funded and backed up every step of the way by the world's major capitalist powers. For them, support for Israel is a logical decision. We live in a world where decisions are based not on what's best for humanity, but on the cruel calculation of profit above all else. And that's the problem at its heart. When you look at the years between the first declaration of British support for a Jewish state in the 1910s and the establishment of Israel in 1948 in an act of ethnic cleansing, the driving force is not just a Zionist ideology which demands expansion. It's the interplay between these demands and the real material interests of imperialism. Freeing Palestine means overthrowing this system of competition between nations and overthrowing those interests.